Welcome to Shenhen on Literacy, the site where we believe there is nothing more noble than to teach somebody to read. I'm Tim Shanahan, your host. Today we're going to get into a question that a teacher sent me. Really, does research support guided reading? And I'm labeling this practical advice on directing student reading. Here's the teacher's question. One of the most important activities in my class is guided reading. Not the guided reading program, we use a textbook, but group work with the children reading under my guidance. Some of our teachers do this with the whole class. I think it works better the way I do it with small reading groups. The students read the text and I ask questions and we talk about it. In my experience, that's helpful. Is there any research support in that? It's an interesting question. And here's my response. Well, first, I think it's important that we set aside the term guided reading. It now appears to be a wholly owned subsidiary of somebody. I guess it always was. Scott Forsman came up with that label in the 1920s to describe their reading lessons, and Irene Founis and Gay Sue Pennell grabbed hold of it successfully in the 1990s, and now it's difficult to talk about it without that connection, and I don't want to get into all of that kind of stuff, so we're just not going to use the term. In the 1940s, to compete with Scott Forsman, other book companies proposed alternative lesson plans for teaching reading. One of them used the term directed reading. These days, no one is likely to confuse that with any commercial enterprise, so let's use that. When we talk about this kind of reading together with kids, we're talking about directed reading. Directed reading refers to those lessons in which students read a selection communally, you know, as a group, and it could be a small group or a large group, but under teacher direction or supervision. The point is to practice reading under the vigilant watch of a teacher who provides guidance and support to ensure success. You're definitely correct that the activity can be done both whole class and small group, but does research support it, is what your question was. And I can give you a definite sort of. The problem here is that there are so many ways that teachers can organize directed reading lessons. Some versions maybe work better than others, but several have been found to confer learning advantages. Going way back, E.L. Thorndike in 1917 found that asking comprehension questions in a reading lesson improved comprehension. When I was becoming a teacher, studies were supporting Russell Stauffer's directed reading thinking activity, which centered the discussions around student-generated predictions instead of teacher-asked questions, and that seemed to work too. Various forms of directed reading have paid off in one way or another. More recent studies have explored the value of approaches like reciprocal teaching and questioning the author, and those seem to be good ideas as well. Those studies prove that it's possible to make any of those varied approaches work. That doesn't mean that all such plans would be effective or that they would work equally well, but there are enough of them for me to conclude that some form of directed reading should be a regular part of any reading program. I've long promoted the idea of dividing instruction among word knowledge, text reading fluency, reading comprehension and writing. Directed reading would go in the reading comprehension slot in that scheme. We'd still be teaching kids how to decode and how to work with morphology. We'd still be working on fluency, and we'd still be teaching writing. But in the reading comprehension slot, certainly what I'm calling directed reading would make sense. Now, given the general value of directed reading, let's consider how teachers might maximize the benefit of this activity. The steps in traditional directed reading activities include 1, pre-teaching new vocabulary. 2, setting a purpose for reading or motivation. 3, the students read text segments as assigned by the teacher. 4, questions and discussions after the reading of each segment. 5, oral reading practice. And so let's talk about each of those. And obviously the oral reading practice, if we spend much time on that, and I think at times we should, that would fit into my text reading fluency section that I was talking about in terms of how I divide up my time. Okay. Well, let's start out with the pre-teaching of vocabulary. Pre-teaching vocabulary is a pedagogical move aimed at protecting comprehension from disruptive effects that unknown words can cause. Students will typically comprehend a text more readily when the teacher has prepared them in this way. But it's important to remember that the purpose of directed reading isn't to guarantee high comprehension on an initial reading. We're trying to teach students to read and to read better. If they're always taking on texts that the teacher guarantees will be comprehended immediately and with minimum effort, we aren't really teaching reading, we're just watching kids practice. I must admit that I have concerns about the pre-teaching of vocabulary. I think a big part of successful reading depends upon dealing with unknown words. That's just part of the reading process. In real life, readers are left to their own devices when it comes to new words. How they deal with them often determines their comprehension. Personally, I would minimize this, increasing attention to vocabulary during the reading activity. Of course, if text is especially heavy in words that I suspect the kids won't get, I might hedge my bets, but that would be rare. During reading, I want to make sure kids are getting the meanings of those words, but I want them to get those because they have understood what the author has said. In other words, they've gotten the words from context. Second step, purpose setting. Teachers have long been encouraged to provide students with purposes for reading. Find out what happens at Janie's birthday party. Or when reading this, pay attention to how many chambers the heart has and what they're called. The idea, I guess, is that good readers read with clear purposes in mind. Is that really the case? Sometimes it certainly is, like when someone is searching for specific information in a text. But I must admit, when I read, I often don't have very specific goals in mind. I want to find out what this study reported or what the characters did in this novel. Very general purposes, not highly specific. I think research supports that notion. When students have very specific purposes set for them, they tend to narrow their focus, increasing the possibility of finding what the teacher asked for while leading the students to ignore the rest of the information. Students with general purposes read to summarize this part of the text or let's find out what happens in this story are more likely to lead to students developing a coherent mental representation of the text than when they're searching for really specific information. If we're really trying to build comprehension and show kids how to what scientists often refer to as create a situation model, that's a representation, a coherent representation of a text in your mind that's based on the information in the text and your prior knowledge about the text, then we don't want kids searching for specific information. We want them really trying to understand and comprehend that text. Be vague here rather than specific. Now the reading. When students are starting out, they need to read aloud. This is true in kindergarten and for at least part of grade one for most kids. Certainly by the time they achieve a high first grade reading level, students can profitably engage in silent reading, though too often teachers avoid this. This avoidance comes out of the same drawer where we keep the pre-teaching of vocabulary. The idea is more to guarantee high comprehension rather than to develop students' ability to read with comprehension. Initially, silent reading is not as effective as oral reading. For some kids, that doesn't start even up until middle school. Accordingly, many teachers engage kids in round-robin reading as if they were all beginning readers. It's better to have these text segments read silently. Admittedly, sometimes you'll have to have kids reread at times. They won't get it the first time. It happens. How are they going to get good at silent reading comprehension? However, if they're never asked to do such reading with a vigilant teacher close by, when you start out with this, keep the segment short, even as short as a sentence or paragraph if that's what's needed. Over time, you can stretch them out, assigning longer segments of text as they develop the facility to do the reading in their minds. Or you can start them out initially with something like whisper reading or mumble reading to try to get them used to actually trying to do the reading without actually saying the words. Questioning and discussion. I know some programs encourage the use of set questioning schemes, perhaps based on Bloom's taxonomy or Raphael's question-answer relations or some other scheme. Research suggests that there are many ways to question students and that it's helpful to ask at least some questions that go beyond literal recall or write their questions. Nevertheless, the benefits of these set questioning schemes tend to be tiny. I'm not a big fan of questioning schemes per se. At least I would discourage the idea of asking one of these kinds of questions and two of those kinds of questions and so on. I'd much rather have the teacher ask questions aimed at identifying whether students comprehended the text well. Don't worry about the kinds of questions, worry about the text. And if not, where things go wrong. What would be important to remember from a given text, and what would you have to do to get that information? What vocabulary had to be understood? Which sentences had to be comprehended if you were going to get the ideas you had to? What connections had to be made of the information across the text? Were there spots where it was necessary to bring in your prior knowledge? What inferences did the students need to make? And so on. If students can't answer the questions, the instruction should show them how, literally taking them back into the text and having them reread, often orally at this point, the part of the text that gave them trouble. So if the students needed to make an inference at some point and their answers to your questions reveal that they didn't do that, I would suggest going back to that point and showing them how it should have worked or having them try it again. Whether you teach this in a small group or whole class, teacher questions, no matter their quality, rarely surface the problems students may be having with text. Partly that's a question-asking problem. We don't really probe into that. We should be. Another reason is that we almost always have some proficient student actually doing the answering. I strongly encourage the use of whiteboards, notebooks, or electronic means of getting everyone to individually answer each question. That way, the teacher can see how each student is doing and can support the comprehension of all students. You know, a teacher can, in a group, look around very quickly and see, wow, two of the kids got it and four of them didn't. I want to take those kids back and see what we can figure out. If I'd called one of those four kids, I would have thought everybody got it. And so having that way of responding to writing really can make a big difference. Another section of it, the oral reading practice. This is usually the final step in most directed reading activities. Many directed reading schemes provide some oral reading practice, usually at the end. When I was a youngster, that was handled round robin style, with each of us reading a sentence or a paragraph until the text had been reread or until each of us had a turn. These days, teachers have a better understanding of fluency development, so things like repeated reading and paired reading have allowed for more oral reading by each child during the same amount of time. And that's great. We definitely should use those methods. I'm less certain about fluency always being the follow-up, however. I fear it encourages teachers to avoid texts that might challenge students' reading abilities, selecting text easy enough to ensure high fluency. Or it forces maximum use of inefficient small group instruction. Small group instruction takes a lot of time. At least for those youngsters likely to be disfluent, I'd suggest having them read the text aloud before taking it on for comprehension. Studies show that this one action can transform many supposedly frustration-level texts into instructional-level ones that students can easily take on successfully. That kind of fluency work can be done in pairs, through echo reading, chorally, at home with cooperative parents, or even with a recording device. The point is to give kids a chance to decode those words, and that kind of repetition has been found to accomplish that. I just read a case study in which the student, when they would read the text once, they would make a slew of mistakes, and when they'd reread it the second time, the number of mistakes dropped by 50%, so it can have a substantial impact. That approach shows kids that they can often make sense of text that they might have thought to be beyond their own means. I think if you teach directed reading, or as you referred to it, guided reading, using some of that advice, I think you'll do better with it. It'll be a more powerful tool. Like you, I think it's really important. The research certainly supports it, but we want to make sure that it's used as effectively and as efficiently as possible. If you would like a written copy of this, go to the Shanahan on Literacy website. It's the April 6th, 2024 entry. Does research support guided reading, practical advice on directed reading, and you will be able to get the written copy of this along with the 11 research references that are made here. Some of these are really quite good, so you might want to do that. And with that, I'm going to end this particular podcast. Let me thank Greg Johnson, our sound engineer, for his fine work. And thank you for tuning in. I hope to see you up the road a piece.